The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to our Space Show webinar today on Sunday. This is our fourth webinar of the year. Thank you all for tuning in. For those of you that are not yet viewing this and you're still on one of our audio streams, if you do want to see the video live, the URL is www.ustream.tv/channel/the-space-show, and you should be able to get right to our video stream. If you have any questions, please do email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. You can call us, and right now the toll-free line is not available. I'll let you know when I open it. I want our guests to be able to put forth their ideas and let you know what we're talking about today before you start calling. But the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. I will let you know when it's connected up and ready to take your calls. A couple of rules when we do webinars: please make your questions and comments pertinent to the discussion. Don't come in and ask something that's not being discussed or that's 180 degrees away or out in left field. We want to stay on topic. And for those of you that have great ideas, theories, and concepts that you want Dan to opine on, or Dr. Juris to opine on, come in with your numbers. Come in with something other than your idea. You know, come in with your references, your credibility. Run the numbers, crunch them. Give us the background data. And if all you've got is rhetoric, because this is your great idea, then you really need to go back to the drawing board and come back later and crunch the numbers and tell us, you know, what you're finding out. And that way there's something to work with. There's not a lot we can do with just a plain idea. So just a couple of hints for you on that type of thing. Now, you can email us, in addition to calling us, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Our website is thespaceshow.com. And there we have our comprehensive newsletter, as always. It'll be uploaded later this afternoon or this evening after our live show today. And there you can find all of the information for our shows that are archived going back to 2001. They're all there. You can easily listen to them right off of our website. You can also easily download these programs. We're coming up on 2,000 programs. They're all archived. And again, if you need help in downloading one, let me know. Email me. And they're all available to you. There is a search item there called Guest Search. And you can do global searches with that, just like you could with any PDF or Word or Excel document. Type in your favorite space term, microgravity, for example, your favorite space guest, Joe Blow, and it will tell you all of the dates those terms or Joe Blow was a guest on the show, or if Joe Blow ever was a guest on the show. Jot the guest dates down, and then you can pull them up on our website archives on our own page. I wish it were interactive, but unfortunately, that is not the case at this time. There is a Space Show store. It is a holiday season, so do check it out. You'll see it up at the top of our website. It's called Space Show Gear. Probably the most important button there is Support the Space Show. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with the OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Our program exists because of the generosity of some of you, and we thank you very much for that. We're deeply appreciative of your support. and we hope you continue our support. Our annual fundraising letter will be going out within a day or so on our newsletter list through Constant Contact. And hopefully you will respond if you do have any questions or you want something other information other than what I'm putting in the letter. Email me, please, at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do remember, we're copyrighted trademark. You can download our programs and you can share them and pass them around. Note that you cannot download the videos. They're uploaded to Vimeo, and I don't know of any way that you can download that file. They are way too big to send to anybody. They're close to 2 gigabytes in size, sometimes larger. But you can, of course, download and share the audio files. Please don't do anything commercial. No edits, no YouTube cuts here and there for YouTube or private websites. And if you do have any questions about what you want to do with the show, let me know. And let's see if we can work something out. Also, we don't permit written transcripts. We don't have permission from the guests for that. And we would appreciate your not doing it, even if it's for your own personal use. We're podcasting, of course. Gigadial.com does our podcasting with Andrew, and you can find the RSS URL on our website and our newsletters. The podcast is audio only. Again, this is a webinar video show, so it will be archived as an audio-only show, as usual, on the Space Show website and the blog, but also the video will be uploaded to Vimeo. I will activate all of the archives simultaneously when the video has been edited and is set to go. The final thing I want to remind everybody is that we're brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. They do promote cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, you can visit their website. It is www.swfound.org. They are the sponsor of our webinar series, and we're deeply appreciative of that. Podcasting, you can find us all over the place, iTunes, Zoom, and a host of other places. If you do have any questions about that, let me know, and we'll be glad to respond to all of your questions. So we have two guests with us, although Dr. Juris, who all of you know, is co-hosting and helping me out today. But our primary webinar specialist and guest is Dan Adamo, who is back with us. And he is a graduate of the University of Rochester, back from 75 in the University of Houston in Clear Lake. And from 79 to 2008, he was employed as a contractor at JSC. Throughout that interval, he was involved with space mission trajectory simulation design and operations. Beginning in 1990, he supported 60 space shuttle flights from Mission Control's Flight Dynamics Officer Console. In July of 2008, he retired from regular employment to pursue astrodynamics research and consulting tasks full-time, and he regularly participates in educational outreach activities, and we're most fortunate that he does space show classrooms and space show programs, and I believe this is our first webinar that we have been fortunate in doing with Dan. And many of you know Dr. Juris. He's frequently a guest on the program. So rather than to continue reading about our guest, I'd rather start the webinar and bring them up. So John and Dan, welcome. And Dan, I know our basic subject is Earth Moon L2. How about a quick description of that for our listeners, and what is significant about it? We've been hearing a lot about it in the news, and it seems to be secretive, maybe NASA behind-the-scenes mission going on, but our mutual friend Josh Hopkins did a show about it, and they seem to be planning for it, and others are talking about it. So why? What's the fuss about it? Why all of a sudden now?
Well, what I'm going to describe is a notional mission to Earth Moon L2, which is a point approximately 60,000 kilometers beyond the moon's far side. Along the Earth-Moon line, if you go out there that distance, about 116% of the distance to the moon, you'll find that the pull of the moon and the pull of the Earth gravitationally are in equilibrium together with the motion that is required to sort of station keep with the moon in its monthly orbit around the Earth. And so you're able to maintain your position there very naturally with very little expenditure of propellant. Chiefly, the propellant necessary to stay exactly at Earth Moon L2 is due to all kinds of small perturbations, but the chief one is the fact that the moon is not in a perfectly circular orbit around the Earth. And then also there's a secondary effect that the sun is also pulling on your spacecraft and trying to pull you out of equilibrium at Earth-Moon L2. But with all those things under consideration, the propellant that we're talking about is very small, smaller than would be required for a visiting vehicle to the space station to station keep in proximity to the space station, a few hundred meters away or something like that. The perturbations disturbing that kind of station keeping are actually larger than station keeping with Moon over its far side at Earth Moon L2. So what good is station keeping there? People have a natural tendency to ask that because, unlike other destinations, there's really nothing there at Earth Moon L2. It's just a theoretical point in space. But obviously we have a grand view of the lunar far side, and one that doesn't change very much. So if there's something of interest on the far side, perhaps some type of robotic vehicle that you're remote controlling through telepresence, you would be able to stay more or less continuously in contact, depending on the little rover's location, and maintain a telepresence on the lunar surface. That also is possible because of a special orbit that this notional mission achieves for about 24 hours. You could achieve it for a much longer duration. But in this notional mission, we spent about 24 hours in what's called a halo orbit, where you aren't exactly at Earth-Moon L2. You're in a orbit around it, which if you viewed that orbit from the Earth would appear to continuously circulate around the moon's limb and make a sort of a halo around the moon. So it's called a halo orbit. And the virtue of doing that, of course, is that you maintain communications with the Earth continuously as you're studying the lunar far side. And then another activity that is enabled by station keeping at Earth Moon L2 and other libration points in the Earth Moon system. But Earth Moon L2 facilitates studying how humans can live safely in the interplanetary environment because it's the moon subtends a very small angle in the sky, not much larger than the Earth would subtend at that distance. And you're basically out in interplanetary space for purposes of assessing the effects of radiation on your spacecraft habitation environment. So you have radiation, the low G, for as long as you need to study them on a human crew, but you're only about 3 to 7 days, depending on the route you choose, 3 to 7 days from home if something goes wrong. So you're in deeper than you are sitting in low Earth orbit on the International Space Station, but you're also not as deep as wading into a mission where you're months away from returning to the Earth. So there's real virtue in this, not only for the study of the lunar far side, but also study of how to maintain a human crew in healthy condition for as long as we want to within any reasonable limit.
John,
so that's what we're doing there.
Okay, John, you had a question for Dan or a comment.
I did. My understanding of the Lagrange points, which there are 5, I believe, is that they are equilibrium points for gravitational fields, but there are 2 conditions then that need to be considered. One is whether there's dynamically stable as well as that is statically in equilibrium. And is L2 dynamically stable, or is it one of those where if you deflect a little bit from the exact point, you're going to sort of fall away from it?
Yeah, they're all sort of quasi-stable. All five of those points are quasi-stable because, as I mentioned earlier, you have the sun in there doing its thing, which the
right.
theory by which you are able to describe these libration points and where they are, that theory assumes a primary body, in this case the Earth, a secondary body, in this case the Moon, and then a perfectly circular orbit for the secondary about the primary. That is not quite the case with the Moon. It has an ellipticity that's appreciable. We also have a fourth body in addition to the spacecraft, the Earth and the Moon, which is the Sun, and it's sort of puts the whole system on an unlevel playing field. So the direction to the sun is always an important consideration if you're trying to do real station keeping. But with all those small perturbations aside, of the five equilibrium points, three of them are located along the Earth-Moon line, and all three of those are only quasi-stable dynamically. They're likened often to saddle points. If you put the saddle such that the direction of the moon's motion around the Earth is along the horn and the tail of the saddle, and then the stirrups are along the Earth-Moon line. The stirrups, if you travel along that Earth-Moon line too much, you're going to tend to fall off the saddle. Whereas if you travel fore and aft on the horse, ahead of and behind the moon, there tends to be a restoring equilibrium in that direction. So the Earth-Moon L1, which is located on the near side of the moon, the Earth-Moon L2 on the far side, and then the Earth-Moon L3, which is on the other side of the moon's orbit from the moon, those three points are saddle points and only quasi-stable. L4 and L5 are located 60 degrees ahead of and behind the moon on the moon's orbit, and because that creates a sort of an equilateral triangle with Earth-Moon L4 or 5 at one vertex, the moon and the Earth at the other vertices, they're often referred to as equilateral points. Those points are theoretically stable in all directions, as I say again, you probably would need to expend some type of propulsive control over your motion there as well. And it's really debatable. You know, you'd have to actually run an experiment, I think, in the real world to see if you expended more or less propellant at Earth-Moon L4 or 5 versus the collinear points.
The film that you have that I told people about on a blog and have promoted during the week, that shows the halo orbit?
It shows really what would the Earth and Moon look like from that halo orbit. There's not a it's such a small segment. This particular design was sort of an abort scenario where you took a slow trip out to Earth-Moon L2 and you stayed there for about a day and then suddenly realized, oh, I need to come home, and I need to come home in a time-critical fashion, so I'm going to take the most propellant expensive route home, or one of the more propellant intensive routes home, and get home as soon as reasonably possible. So the trip back comes at an expense in propellant, but it covers the distance back to the Earth more quickly. Because of that, the time spent at the libration point doesn't describe a full halo by any means. A halo usually takes a couple weeks to describe, and we're only going to spend one day there.
Okay. And you have a PDF document that we also put up on a blog that explains more of this in detail, correct?
That's right. When we start sharing, I'd actually like to start with that that particular document. That'll give us a good overview on terminology and just give us some sort of God's eye view of what this trajectory is.
Do you want to go ahead and pull that up then for us now at this
That'd
time?
That'd be great.
Okay, so while you're doing that, listeners, you can see it from Dan's screen sharing on the webinar, or you can also minimize us, and you can go to the Space Show blog And it is there. The PDF document is there on the blog for you to use that way. And the video or the movie that we're going to talk about in a few minutes is in the QuickTime format. So if you want to watch it directly from the blog, just follow those instructions I put there for the URL. But you must use the QuickTime player. If you don't have QuickTime on your computer, you're not going to be able to play that format. So you definitely want to do that. And let's see, I need to bring this over here. I think that's it, correct, Tom? And then I want to hide this, correct? There we go. I'm learning, guys. So you can either look at the PDF as Dan is doing it through screen sharing on our webinar, or you can go to our blog and pull it up that way or at your leisure. Go ahead, Dan, because we have it up on the screen now.
Very good. So for those folks that are following along on their own and not using the stream, you have better resolution probably than the video stream. So I'm going to try to let you know where I am if you're doing your own viewing. Anytime we're stopping the video, I'll try and say where we've stopped in terms of elapsed time, minutes, and seconds, so you can use your QuickTime to get in sync with us. If you're looking at the stream, then some of the fine print may not be visible at the reduced resolution, so I'll also try and keep those folks apprised of any fine print that I'm looking at. But hopefully you can read what I've got up there now. I'll just sort of paraphrase through the first few paragraphs until we get to the graphics and the tables. So as we said, the Earth-Moon L2 point is about 60,000 kilometers above the far side of the moon from the Earth. Strategic location. There's two types of trajectories that were studied in this study that I participated in earlier this year, where we have a flyby trajectory that uses the moon's gravity well to act as sort of leverage for a maneuver performed at the closest point of approach to the moon. This maneuver, since you're flying by the moon on its trailing side, if you did nothing at that point, you would tend to leave the Earth-Moon system entirely, which is the way the Apollo program disposed of the Saturn V third stage to Saturn IV-b on many occasions, not all, but many occasions they just sent it out into solar orbit by flying by the moon's far side. The moon's trailing side. In this case, what we're doing is using that leverage that the moon's gravity well gives us to allow us to do a very small burn, 100 meters per second, 150 meters per second, to slow down slightly so that instead of going off out of the Earth-Moon system, we tend to pass very close to Earth-Moon L2, and we do so at a reduced speed so that it's very easy to get into that semi-equilibrium condition with a rather small propulsive maneuver at that point and enter one of these halo orbits in the vicinity of Earth-Moon L2. The return trip that we're going to make after just one day of loitering at Earth-Moon L2 vicinity in the halo orbit is called the direct trajectory. And that never gets closer to the moon than pretty much when you're in the vicinity of Earth-Moon L2. In the case we're going to play with, we actually stop our motion that we have station keeping with Earth-Moon L2 and the moon. We stop that geocentric motion similar to the orbit of the moon around the Earth and just fall to the Earth. And we do it in such a way that we achieve the proper entry conditions for the assumed Orion spacecraft that we are we're flying in. So let me scroll down here to the bottom of the first page where we're looking at Table 1, and you can see what's going on there in terms of timing. We use notation here, this is a hypothetical mission off in the future. We're using 2017, January 1st, as the launch date from the Kennedy Space Center. It turns out that the most efficient launch off in an easterly direction is shortly after 4 p.m. Universal Time, which I guess at that time of year, minus 4 hours, would be just after noon local time at the Kennedy Space Center. The launch vehicle then proceeds for about 8 minutes to place the spacecraft and an upper stage attached to it into a very eccentric orbit. You can see there the height of apogee is 1,800 kilometers. The height of perigee is only about 93 kilometers, and that's actually below the Earth's surface. And the reason for this is to have a sort of a fail-safe disposal condition for the Space Launch System's core stage. So that that core stage, once it gets into this kind of orbit, very similar to the external tank of the space shuttle, it'll just enter the atmosphere and burn up over the Pacific Ocean, where it's going to do minimal damage to anything. And the spacecraft continues on its merry way. Of course, it has to do a maneuver that raises that perigee from below the Earth's surface to some point above, and that's what happens at the apogee at about 1,800 kilometers above the Earth's surface. About 40 minutes later on the other side of the orbit after orbit insertion at NECO, we go into this perigee raise burn, which doesn't take much delta V, or change in speed, 73 meters per second, and that raises the low point from minus 93 kilometers up to plus 157, which was considered by this study to be a nice minimal perigee altitude. A few minutes later, and this was since determined to be probably impractical, we'd have to wait like not just a few minutes later till the next perigee, but a whole orbit in a fraction later, because we don't have enough time to check out systems and prepare for departing the Earth's vicinity with this translunar injection burn. And you can see that's a rather hefty burn. Both it and the small perigee raise burn are performed by the interim cryopropulsion stage, the ICPS, which is a delta force heavy upper stage. That was the assumption in the study. And that delta V there is very close to the ICPS's capacity, especially when you add in the extra 73 meters per second it presumably performed to get you into safe perigee condition. So that's a sobering result of this study, is that we were right on the hairy edge of being able to fly what a lot of us considered sort of a minimal mission under these circumstances. You do a lunar flyby almost exactly 4 days later, about 100 kilometers above the moon's surface, and that's where we do this little slowdown burn of 213 meters per second, so we don't fly off the solar orbit and pass very close to Earth-Moon L2. That's an interesting transit time between translunar injection or launch and this lunar flyby. It's only about 4 days, and that's already about a day longer than the Apollo missions took to get to the moon. They were very concerned in Apollo about minimizing the amount of time that it took to get to the moon. In this case, we weren't so critically bound by that. So this actually winds up being propellant-wise a more efficient way to get to the moon, but you do take an extra day. Takes a number of additional days to reach halo orbit insertion, HOI, where you're finally in the vicinity of Earth-Moon L2 and the conditions are nearly optimal to achieve a halo orbit. Notice again, it takes only about 137 meters per second to do that because we set up the arrival conditions using the lunar flyby burn. So this is very cheap on propellant to get out to halo orbit. But time-wise, it took about 7.4 days to get there. So it's a little over a week to get there. Coming back after a day, and exactly a day in the halo orbit, we go and do the trans-Earth injection burn. And you can see the delta V there is huge. That depletes almost all the propellant that was loaded onto the service module as assumed under the study for the Orion. Now, of course, nobody really knows what the Orion service module is. I've even heard discussions about the European Space Agency being asked to develop that service module as a sort of a spin-off from their automated transfer vehicle that visits the ISS with cargo. So there's telling what the delta V capacity of that service module is. Maybe it'll be more like the Apollo service module, which could generate almost 3 kilometers per second of delta V on just the itself and the command module, which is a lot more capability than we're looking at here. But be that as it may, even though you invested a lot of delta V on this trans-Earth injection burn, you get back to the Earth and achieve atmospheric entry interface in only 5.7 days. And if you'd wanted to spend even more propellant, you could have gotten back even sooner, sort of like the maneuver that the Apollo 13 did after it passed by the moon. It basically burned at the Earth in that direction and just increased its inbound radial speed toward the Earth and trimmed a good fraction of a day off of its transit time to back to the Earth's atmosphere. So on the last line of table one, you can see entry interface is achieved just under 11 kilometers per second, which I believe was a constraint for that trajectory. So that's achieved, and it also achieved a number of other entry constraints that were specific to the Orion vehicle, including coming back to California. And you'll see how that has to be done with the timing and geometry that we have when we get into some of these diagrams in the video. So I'll proceed on to the second.
Okay, hold on. A couple of things. One is, listeners, I am going to turn our phone line on, but again, if you do have questions, make them relevant to the discussion that's ongoing with Dan and the rest of us. The line is 1-866-687-7223. I'm getting over a cold, so you still hear voice problems with me. And Dr. Jurist had a question or comment.
I did, Dan. If my arithmetic's right, totaling up the delta V that you have in that nominal mission, it totals out to be 4,387 meters a second. And that's a really significant fraction of the delta V required just to get from the surface up to the orbit, the initial orbit that you established there in LEO. Isn't that correct?
Well, that's true. Of course, it's being performed by at least two propulsive systems. We considered that the TLI burn and the perigee raise burn would be performed by the ICPS upper stage. That is a good hunk of what you're talking about there,
right.
3 kilometers per second. And then the rest of it's performed by the Orion spacecraft, presumably its service module. Of course, if we could have taken a slope boat home like we flew out there on, you wouldn't need anything like the 1,200 meters per second for the transverse injection burn, which departs the moon's vicinity and heads you toward the Earth. This is a technique called achieving capture in the Apollo days, where you pretty much just stop your angular momentum with respect to the Earth and just let it pull you in. And you do so in a controlled fashion so that you wind up with entry conditions that are survivable. You obviously don't want to go screaming straight down into the Earth's atmosphere radially into the center of the Earth. You will perish from heat loads and be crushed under the acceleration load. So this isn't anything quite as simple as just burning at the Earth and hoping. You have to do it in a controlled fashion and be prepared to do course corrections and all that, which weren't modeled in this very preliminary notional design.
And so what you're doing is basically controlling your atmospheric entry angle and keeping it relatively low, relative to the horizon.
That's right. The last thing you want to do is fly from the moon toward the near side of the Earth, because that'll be these crushing loads of thermal loads and mechanical loads on the vehicle, and you'll just burn up. What you actually need to do is fly to a point called the antipode on the far side of the Earth from the moon, and that's the same way you depart as well. You don't fly off in the moon's direction from the side of the Earth that can see the moon, or see the moon where it will be when you arrive 3 or 4 days later, but instead you depart from this antipode at a low angle with respect to the horizontal at that local position, and go sailing off toward the moon in a much more efficient fashion.
The other thing is that that additional delta V looks to me like somewhere between a third and half again as much as basically what it takes to launch into LEO. And for listeners who aren't really familiar with a lot of these concepts, that's a really significant jump in the total delta V compared to what it just takes to get into a low Earth orbit. And of course, all the capability for doing that has to be carried up to low Earth orbit. And so the total mass of a vehicle sitting on the pad is going to be considerably higher than it would be to put similar payload just into LEO. Is it not true?
That's true. LEO is, like where space station flies, is a bit over 7 kilometers per second, so 7,000 meters per second. And we're going to require a subsequent delta V of almost 4,400 meters per second for your sum.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead with your document, Dan.
Okay. Oops, screensaver there. Excuse me. So I'll go down to the second page here where we get a little more graphic and more like what we sort of this freeze frame and six-figure pictures, vice what we'll see on the movie. So here's a view in the parking orbit plane. This is post-NECO, which you see down at the bottom here. NECO this is sort of shorthand for 1 day, 16 hours, 13 minutes, January 2017 in universal time. And so the launch occurs over here just to the left of that point at Kennedy Space Center. And then we go into this looping elliptical orbit, and you can see the gray shading here is the Earth's hemisphere that's at nighttime. So we had a lit launch over on the other side, the lit side of the Earth. And also drafted on the Earth are its equator, which almost corresponds with its limb. And then up here, offset from the center of the Earth, is a small circle that is 80 degrees north latitude, just to let you know where the North Pole is. And, of course, on January 1st, the North Pole is in darkness. And then we also have, to sort of give you the third dimension, we have these dotted lines, which I hope are visible to folks that are watching the stream. These dotted lines that come from the time ticks, which are pulses on the blue trajectory, the Orion trajectory. And these dotted lines are trying to show you distance from the Earth's equatorial plane. So if we start at NECO, the distance to the Earth's equatorial plane is indicated at 1 day, 16 hours, 20 minutes by this vertical line here that goes above the plus sign, and that means you're north of the equator. And then you start going progressively closer to the equator at these 10-minute intervals that we've indicated with the little plus ticks. And by the time you get to 1 day, 16 hours, 40 minutes, you're pretty much crossing the equator southbound. And then subsequently you see dotted lines going downward from the plus sign they're connected to, the tick, time tick they're connected to. And by the time you get down to 1 day 17 hours, even 1 day 17:10, you're about as far south of the Earth equator as you're going to get. Meanwhile, you pass through apogee, the high point of the orbit, up there over 1,000 kilometers high, and that's where you want to do your perigee rays to get it out of the Earth's atmosphere so that you have a safe orbit. And then in this design, we follow that safe orbit after the perigee rays is down to the other side, which is near the antipode, and that's where we want to do our translunar injection burn. You can see it's pretty substantial, 2,700 meters per second. And that causes us not to remain in the Earth's vicinity any longer and head off into deep space toward the moon. So if there aren't any questions there, I'll move on.
Okay.
Okay. And this is an overview of what happens subsequently. You can see the trajectory that we were looking at before is confined right here to the Earth's vicinity. You can see over here's the apogee point, and then we come down and do the translunar injection burn at a point opposite of where we arrive in the vicinity, which is over here, 4 days later. So we do that burn and then sail out to the moon, get our little gravity assist, do our little tiny burn there at, on the 5th of January. And then we're sort of moving. You can sort of draw lines between the spacecraft and the moon in red, showing how you get ahead of the moon initially at 6 days, or the 6th of January, 0 hours UTC. And then the 7th of January, we're still ahead. But we're slowing down as we get further beyond the moon's orbit. And by the 8th of January, the moon's starting to catch up to us. 9th of January, we're barely ahead of it. And 1 hour and 40 minutes after the 9th of January begins in universal time, we do a little tiny maneuver that lets us coast along the Earth-Moon line for a day until 10 days, 1 hour and 40 minutes, exactly 1 day later, when we pretty much stop our motion with respect to the Earth and let the moon continue on in its orbit. You can see that we may be just slightly ahead of the moon at 10 days. If you look at those two time ticks, just slightly ahead of the moon, but we pretty much put the brakes on at that point, and the moon goes sailing off ahead of us subsequently while we just fall in toward the Earth achieve our entry interface. So these next diagrams, if there aren't any questions, I'll continue on.
Yeah, keep going.
One thing I should say before I move on is the little projections that you see vertically here on the moon's orbit and on the spacecraft orbit, those are with respect to the moon, well, with respect to the Earth's orbit plane around the sun. And the moon's only inclined about 5 degrees with respect to that plane. So you can see the moon has these short little stubby lines going, showing that the moon is in this case at 8 days, 8 January, 8 days into the month, that it's below the Earth's orbit plane around the sun, and then the spacecraft is also below the Earth's orbit plane around the sun by a slightly larger amount. It's further from the moon's orbit than the moon is. Further from the Earth than the moon's orbit is. And the reason for that bias southward is that's where a lot of the scientific investigations that we heard, for example, Josh Hopkins talk about from Earth-Moon L2, we want to concentrate on the South Pole Aiken Basin of the moon. And we may not be able to keep the South Pole of the moon in view for a two-week halo orbit, but we can bias the time we spend in that halo orbit so that it has a northern bias or a southerly bias, and in this case we saw the southerly bias. So we actually see more of the moon's southern hemisphere far side than its northern hemisphere far side. And so those projection lines show you what's going on there. And then we actually come back to the Earth from that southerly location. We actually have to fly under the Earth's south pole to get to the west coast U.S. longitude that we want to fly toward from entry to splashdown for the Orion. So that creates some very interesting geometry. I'll just go to the last page to show you that. Let's go up. And this is the terminal approach to the Earth with time ticks every 10 minutes. So we're moving at a pretty good speed as we start in the lower right-hand corner of the diagram. And then you can see that speed actually increase noticeably as you approach entry interface there at 15 days, 17 hours, 19 minutes. And the FPA I stands for flight path angle, and that's just the angle of the velocity vector with respect to the local horizontal at entry interface, which is getting down into the atmosphere so that you're actually physically able to sense the acceleration that it's exerting on your spacecraft, slowing you down to the atmospheric friction. So you're coming in a shallow dive there, almost 6 degrees below the local horizontal. And that was one of the targeting conditions for the Orion spacecraft used for this design. Going back to the lunar flyby diagram, the one on page 4 is probably easier to follow. This is an inertial coordinate system, just like the previous diagrams we've been looking at. And the direction to the Earth is annotated over here on the upper right-hand side. And then you see, again, the moon-shaded portion is its night side. And so if you were looking at the moon from the Earth, you would see it in a first quarter, almost the first quarter phase. It'd probably still be a waxing crescent. Then we come in from the bottom right on the Orion spacecraft, and these are ticks at every hour with projections onto the lunar equatorial plane, do the flyby, and you can see down is annotated as the moon's geocentric inertial velocity. So we're flying by the trailing edge of the moon, and the moon tends to pull us in a downward direction, amplifying our speed with respect to the Earth, and it'll throw us into solar orbit if we don't do anything. So there's a small little delta to get 33 meters per second. Send us out ahead of the moon and over its far side, and eventually the moon catches up to us as we halo orbit insertion. And on page 5, you can see all that sort of play out together with the trans-Earth injection. With respect to the moon, but this time we're actually going to rotate the vertical axis of this plot so that it always coincides with the Earth-Moon line. So it's not an inertial coordinate system. And in fact, the moon that you see annotated down here near the bottom, that's the southern hemisphere of the moon. Moon is moving to the right toward the leading direction when Orion leads the moon to the right of the moon. And so we're actually looking at the southern hemisphere of the moon as it orbits the Earth. And, of course, the Earth is toward the bottom again. I'll move that down here so you can see. Here's the direction toward the Earth. And so we start leading the moon, and then we go trailing the moon at periapsis. That's the closest approach point to the moon. And then go sailing out in front of the moon, beyond the moon's orbit from the Earth, 7 days, 12 hours. These ticks are at six-hour intervals. And then finally, as we approach the Earth-Moon line, which would be a vertical axis from the moon straight upward, just before we get to the Earth-Moon line, still leading the moon, is where we enter this halo orbit. in the halo orbit, if we actually did it for 2 weeks, would just sort of describe about, I think it was a 10,000 kilometer amplitude. So it's really not going to be much larger than one of these axis labels that you see on the vertical or horizontal axes. They're 10,000 kilometers per inch, basically, on the scale. And so you would see a halo orbit play out pretty much like this. And it would be in actually three dimensions, so it would be pretty hard to describe on the diagram. And then we do trans-Earth ejection. And, of course, in this diagram, that means we stop all motion while the moon continues to the right in an inertial coordinate system. So the motion of the spacecraft just goes way off to the left. And you can see this huge acceleration between these six-hour time ticks between before the trans-Earth ejection burn and then afterwards. They get much larger, showing that motion with respect to the moon greatly accelerated. And you can also see it start to fall toward the Earth, light vertical direction to the motion, vertically downward.
So,
I think that is all we want to talk about here, unless there's questions.
Yeah, well, I've got some questions for you. When I go to conferences and I hear people talking and presenting, you know, their papers, their ideas about this type of mission or that type of mission, or some of them will call the space show and do the same thing. And again, I'm not an engineer, and I certainly don't have your background, so in a way, it's unfair for me to even ask the question. But nobody have I ever heard even talk about the kind of planning and analysis and concepts that you're talking about today. So I guess my question is, in your parlance, in your world, are you talking really, really super-duper heavy-duty advanced everything? Or is this really the basics of planning a mission, and people that talk at conferences or maybe, you know, our guest on the show or something, either they've dumbed it down for all of us who are not orbital dynamics specialists or mission planning specialists, or maybe they just don't know. But what goes into what you've just been talking about? This seems to me like it's really heavy duty, intense planning with lots and lots and lots of considerations of lots and lots of factors and variables.
Oh, yeah. The software that actually designed this trajectory is only for use on NASA contracts. It's called Copernicus, and was developed by UT Austin folks. Cesar Ocampo certainly was the lead initially, and then a guy I work with a lot is Juan Sennett, who was, I believe, a grad student of Cesar's, and is now at Johnson Space Center and leading a small team that continues to advance Copernicus capabilities and maintain it. And Copernicus acts sort of like a front end to a huge computational engine that does trajectory optimization according to specified constraints, which can be anything from, you know, time of flight to that flight path angle we were talking about to the speed of entry interface. And it's really an amazing process whereby you specify these constraints, some initial guesses perhaps on trajectory parameters to help define maybe how you're departing the Earth or how you're arriving at the Moon. And then you turn it loose with this optimization algorithm and watch it evolve from a series of poorly met constraints to hopefully all constraints being met with a nice continuous trajectory that has a few engine burns to iron out the kinks in that trajectory, and that's your design in the end. I'm sure that a lot of people at conferences do this work, but at the conferences that you go to, you know, that is often either a trade secret or don't want to encumber the audience with all the details you had in arriving at the results, unless it's something new and innovative, and that may be more of the focus of the paper. But you can rapidly glaze over an audience, and I hope I'm not doing that myself here, with the trajectory design process, as opposed to just, you know, discussing the results. And then, see, after Copernicus had its day and crunched these numbers to design the trajectory, then what I do is import that trajectory into software I've written that helps visualize, and that's where these plots come from. Then another way to export Copernicus solution, trajectory solutions, is to send them off for importation into this 3D planetarium software called Celestia. And some of you may know about Celestia. It's an open source project that really is amazing in its ability to render in three dimensions the trajectory of a spacecraft or a totally fictitious eye point that you're just moving around in space like you've got warp drive. Depending on what you're doing in Celestia, you can be fantastic about your journey through space or actually import one of these high-fidelity designs that satisfy all these constraints. And then you can render what you're looking at out the window or what your spacecraft trajectory looks like relative to other bodies in space. Pretty much assume any viewpoint that you like, including traveling along with the spacecraft. So the video is just a script running in Celestia using the imported trajectory that Copernicus designed, and then recording that script after I iterated on it. I guess the things I wanted to show rendered. The video of that script is then in QuickTime for us to look at. And we'll proceed through it really in two pieces, one with a sort of a God's eye view from above, and then another one, what would you see if you were flying on the Orion spacecraft as you flew, you know, out to the moon and Earth now too.
So I guess for those of us who hear a presentation or maybe a guest comes on the show or something, and they start in with, we can easily go to Mars or NEO or something, the question would be, have you done trajectory analysis, and what does that show you, and can you tell us about that analysis? And they'll either know what we're talking about and be able to share something, or we'll play stump the teacher, I guess, right?
Yeah, and you know, this video was done actually originally for a group of teachers. The public affairs folks at Johnson Space Center had us sort of pro bono take our aspects of flying out to Earth, Moon, L2 and put them into this PDF and the video to share with middle school and high school teachers that were interested in capturing some technical content and repackaging it for their students so that they get a little aware of what NASA's up to these days. And it's really great that NASA was willing to take some very preliminary work. Let's face it, even 2017 is pretty optimistic for flying this mission. It's probably up there in the next decade, early in the next decade, if we're fortunate, before we fly a mission like this. We're on the ragged edge in a number of performance limitations of vehicles that are currently, they're starting to bend some metal of components, but we certainly don't have any, you know, rocket stages ready to go yet, particularly in the core stage.
Well, so
really preliminary work.
Well, we're about to do a break because we're an hour into the program at the halfway point. But I guess this sort of redefines when I talk about him to people about doing mission analysis, payload analysis, trajectory analysis, all of that. Would be quite a. I guess this redefines what I'm talking about. John, do you have any comments before we go off to break?
Well, I just think the listeners might find it helpful to get some idea of how much time and energy this involves. Dan, do you have any kind of a rough estimate of how many man months or man weeks or man years goes into something like this to the point where you can present it?
We spent, from early March, basically, to June time frame, crunching numbers, and I'm not talking about just one trajectory design like you're seeing here. There were thousands of trajectory designs spanning about 20 years at pretty much daily intervals, just to assess, you know, how do cheap propulsion requirements give way to more expensive propulsion requirements if you insist on launching any day during the 20-year interval. And so this is just scratching the tip of the iceberg in terms of the number of solutions this team of experts crunched out. And then, you know, tried to do some statistics on, okay, if you set your bar this high in terms of vehicle performance, what percentage of days can you fly your mission? And that kind of thing. And it had some very meaningful results and was amazing. And then in the June, July, August time frame, we were at a much lower level of effort and preparing, you know, pro bono in my case, this package for the educators. And I would think you're talking many man months there, even though we're all doing it part-time.
Does the size of the rocket, the payload, heavy lift, not so heavy lift, does that enter into your trajectory analysis?
Oh, it does hugely. Particularly the imbalance between the SLS core stage that we assumed and the upper stage, the interim upper stage, which never was really, you know, in the core stage sizing requirements. It was sort of like a way to get an upper stage onto the SLS quickly in its development cycle, because there isn't the budget with the flat budget that we have at NASA. There isn't the budget to actually develop the intended second stage for the core stage in parallel with that core stage. So that's why you have this huge elliptical orbit. It's burning that core stage to depletion with a much lighter payload than it intended to deliver into the post-NECO orbit. And you have this elliptical orbit as a result, and that imposes itself some operational constraints, because you have this sort of fixed direction that you'd like to go off in, and the moon may not be in that direction when you are flying your mission. So in this case, it turned out pretty well. But in other cases, on other days, it would not turn out so well, and you might have to stand down with that particular vehicle.
John, anything before we go to break?
No, I think that answers the question and helps give the listeners a perspective on just how complex and time-consuming all of this is to do, any analyses of this type.
You're doing this on a Mac, right, Dan?
I am actually showing this on a Mac, and the diagrams that you're looking at were rendered on a Mac as well as the movie, but the Copernicus software runs on a Mac, but only in emulation mode, so it's really trying to run native under Windows operating system.
Okay. Listeners, we're going to take a pause. We're halfway into our webinar, and we're going to be back in a couple of minutes. We will be taking more of some of your calls if you want to call in and talk to Dan or John or myself. That toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. If we've blown you away or overwhelmed you, I apologize. Call in, talk to us. And we'll be back with Dan and John and myself in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. I'm the host of your Sunday Space Show webinar program, David Livingston. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. And with us on our webinar today is Dan Adamo and Dr. John Juris, who's co-hosting with me. And right now you don't see our images, but you see the beginning freeze frame of the QuickTime movie that Dan is going to take us through as a follow-through from what we were talking about in trajectory analysis during the first part of the webinar. Our toll-free number is available, and it is 1-866-687-7223, and also email, of course, if you wish to email us, drspace@thespaceshow.com. So, Dan, I'll turn it back to you. Tell us what we're going to watch. And again, listeners, this is on our blog, but it is a QuickTime movie, and you would need QuickTime to play it. Although you might be able to play it off of the URL that I have there on the blog, so if you want a cleaner resolution than what we're able to do on the streaming, there is that avenue as well. It's already on the blog. Just follow the instructions to be able to get to it and play the movie. What are we looking at, Dan?
Well, this is the Earth as seen from a point about 100,000 kilometers from the surface. So we're about almost a quarter of the way to the moon. The distance is given in this upper left portion, and what we're tracking in the center of the field in terms of some body or spacecraft is indicated here in the upper left. So we're looking at the Earth, and it's just going to, no matter where we fly, we will keep the Earth centered in the field of view, and that's pretty much the mode we have through most of this movie. We're looking at something. It may not be the Earth, and we try and keep it in the center of field of view unless we're panning from one thing to another as a transition. And then we'll lower left corner, viewers watching the stream may actually be able to make out the captions that I pre-scripted in here in the lower left-hand corner. So, you know, it says the following Orion trajectory design targets a brief stop 70,000 kilometers beyond the moon. Yeah, the translunar libration point is L2.
Okay, real quick.
Go ahead.
I was going to say real quick before you cut, somebody called and is sitting there on hold. And caller, I'm not bringing you up on the air. I want Dan to go through his movie. So you're going to have to sit tight or call back because we need to get the movie out there first and to get this presentation done. In fact, I think what would be better, caller, is if you call back after we go through the movie. So I've turned the line off again, but call back when the movie ends. We do want to hear from you, but that'll work better. Okay, Dan, back to you.
Okay, and then the information on the lower right and upper right is Celestia-generated bookkeeping information, particularly the upper right, maybe interest to people that are playing this on their own. It gives the time and universal time, January 1st at 16 hours, 12 minutes, 50 seconds in the year 2017. And below it says real time, so that means when we start flowing the movie, will be running in real time, and this will just count up second by second like your wall clock is, just way ahead of us. But throughout the movie, we will be accelerating the flow of time to avoid taking days to play it back. Trajectory lasts pretty much 2 weeks, so we'll be doing all kinds of what I call step-ahead mode. And I try and show you, you know, we're going in the caption there. It'll say, you're going 12,000 times real time. That's just an indication of, you know, these things are flying by at this rate because we're stepping time ahead.
Okay.
So we'll also make stops wherever you and John want to ask questions. And I will try to remember to let people know who are generating this QuickTime movie on their local computers for max resolution. I'll try and let them know what time we are stopped at in terms of in this playback control here. You see elapsed time in minutes or hours, minutes, and seconds. So I'll try and call that out when we stop.
Okay. Do you want to take calls during the movie, or would you rather wait until you're through with the movie?
I think I'd be better off if we waited, and if people are able to describe where we were, have them just jot it down, you know, please just jot down where we were in the movie, and then we can use the slider bar controls to reproduce where we were when you have a question about the movie itself. Otherwise, I think we'll go sailing on past where the question was even relevant in the flow of time. So you and John can ask the question fast enough. Somebody that's dialing in probably can't, so we'll just go back to where we were answer the question, hopefully.
Okay, and listeners, if you're burning to get something in on the movie, where we are, real time, email me real quick, and I'll interject it as if it were coming from John or me. So why don't you go ahead and start, Dan?
Okay, so off we go, starting. And you can see us zooming in to the Earth just to get a close view, and then here's what should be a familiar trajectory. You can see it in the white here, this elliptical orbit that we achieve. And then there's a sort of an interesting spot. I'll stop it here where it naturally is scripted to stop. We're currently 19 seconds into the video. And you can see Orion is shown. Its location is shown just by the text, which you may or may not actually be able to resolve if you're watching the stream. But you can see it down here. We're south of Asia at the apogee point of the orbit. And an interesting thing to note is that the apogee prior to TLI in this design, Orion's crew will be farther from the Earth than anyone since Apollo 17 when they flew to the moon in December 1972. So we'll be, you know, 1,000 kilometers above the Earth's surface at that point. And it just shows how the space station is, you know, pretty much an orange peel's width, like this injection point, this MECO point up at the 1 o'clock position relative to the Earth. That's where space station orbits, basically, is an orange peel's width above the Earth's surface. So we get out here quite a distance before we start for the moon. And so I'll start this thing again at 19 seconds mark. And after a brief pause, it'll start moving through translunar injection. And breathe again there. And then we'll take a broader viewpoint so we can see the trajectory actually play out flying to the moon. And the interesting thing about this to me is that it looks like we're going to beat the moon. You can see the moon up here. It looks like we're going to beat the moon to the point in the moon's orbit where we actually fly by it. But we slow down so much due to Earth gravity, going uphill the whole time, that the moon actually beats us to the point where we cross its orbit. You see the flyby right there. We freeze again in the script and make note of the maneuver we do at that point. Slow this down just a little more, and you can see how we're constantly ahead of the moon as we head out toward Earth-Moon L2. Constantly ahead of it, but the moon's catching up as we continue to slow down due to increasing our altitude from the Earth. And then where you see this little kink right there, that's where we enter the halo orbit. So from there to the next kink is the arc of the halo orbit during one day. And then we put the brakes on right at that point. And you can see the moon already is starting to get ahead. I froze it there in Celestia, but you can see we're barely moving with respect to the Earth, and the moon just continues on in its orbit. So we fall rapidly behind. And this is the direct trajectory that doesn't get any nearer the moon than when it was near Earth Moon L2. Across the moon's orbit. And you can see how fast we're romping along here at 12,000 times real time, the Earth rotating very rapidly. And then we come to a stop at this phase of the video and go to the second phase where we're going to ride along with the spacecraft and see what it's like out the window. Here we are right close to the Earth, and now we're departing it after translunar injection. See the Earth falling away. And now we're going out into space to the point where the Earth starts to rotate beneath us like we were the moon or something. We don't move eastward amongst the continents and the oceans anymore. They start rotating to bring our ground track back westward like a rising and setting sun or moon. And then we pan around. You can see the sun there. And there's the moon as we begin approaching it for the flyby. And all the stars are rendered by Celestia very nicely. You can see the sun moving amongst the stars in Sagittarius, being the start of winter. And the moon, of course, in so closely in alignment with the sun, all we see is the unlit side with a tiny, tiny crescent on the upper right corner. But as we get closer, we slow down to 600 times real time. And now you'll see us fly by the moon so close that Celestia can't even really render any features sharply, particularly at this 600 times real time. But the near side of the moon is on the right, far side is disappearing on the left. Fly over the northern part of the moon, and there's the far side of the moon now. We're ahead of and beyond the moon in orbit around the Earth. And now you can see the Earth on the lower right-hand corner. We're far enough ahead of the moon that the Earth and moon aren't into alignment, but as the moon begins to overtake us, as we head toward Earth Moon L2, the Earth will start coming back into the field, and they become very closely aligned. But because we're on the, we have that southerly bias in our halo orbit, the Earth is below the moon because we're south of the moon's equator. And then here we are entering the halo orbit, and we're only going 3,000 times real time. They see the Earth slowly rotating as we do this halo orbit. And if we did an entire halo orbit, you'd see the Earth just sort of circle the moon during the 2 weeks that it took to describe the halo. The whole time we're watching the moon's far side and communicating with the Earth simultaneously. And that sudden change in motion, that's when we did trans-Earth injection. So the moon starts leaving us behind in its orbit. We continue tracking it, but we're actually falling toward the Earth at the same time.
Dan, I got an email.
And then we pan over to look at the Earth.
I got an email.
Need to freeze?
Yeah, freeze it for a second. I have an email question from a Jack in Boston. And he says, Dan, this is really awesome, but I'm curious, was some kind of something similar to this done to send Mars Science Lab to Mars? If you were planning a humans to Mars mission, would you be doing something similar to this in trajectory analysis to get your humans to Mars? Or is the moon a unique thing because of EML2?
Oh, no, there's nothing unique about the process of designing these trajectories. I was somewhat aware of the Curiosity mission planning from the trajectory viewpoint because some of the folks at Johnson Space Center that I used to work with before I retired 4 years ago, we're partnering with JPL, particularly on the entry guidance phase of the entry, descent, and landing of Curiosity. And they were actually resurrecting old Apollo entry guidance software to do that, where you have a, you know, a capsule, in this case occupied by Curiosity, that has a properly offset center of gravity so that depending on how you roll about the axis of symmetry of that capsule, you can generate lift up or lift down or laterally and control your lateral approach to a desired landing point, and then control the range to that landing point as well. Much like the tunnel does, but this is actual software that was adapted for Curiosity's entry that used to fly on Apollo. So there's all this. This process that you're seeing here is done by not only human, not only in support of human trajectory development, but also for these high ticket robotic vehicles to fly their trajectories as well.
Okay. John, anything from you before we go on?
No, I just think it's really helpful to keep illustrating the complexity of these processes for our listeners.
Yeah, I should add, you know, John, I should add, too, that there's a YouTube video that Dr. Logan from a former space show guy and
right.
I put together that shows an approach to Mars using Celestia, where we were trying to rendezvous with its outer moon, Deimos. And if you just go to YouTube and do a search on Deimos rendezvous, you'll come across that video, and it's fascinating to watch the approach play out. It was actually a very similar approach to the one that Curiosity made, only instead of entering the atmosphere, we went into an elliptical orbit around Mars and then intercepted Deimos before we got to atmosphere.
We actually talked about that on a classroom show with Jim and John and you and myself 2 or 3 years ago. I remember talking about that.
Yep. That was sort of emphasis for us to go off and capture it visually, and that's on YouTube. So you can see how you can do the same kind of thing with Celestia, capturing a high-fidelity trajectory design in virtually any context and then rendering it in three dimensions.
You have a caller. Sure. Are you ready to take your caller? Dan?
Yeah.
Do you want to take a call?
Yeah,
I have a caller on hold. Hi, caller.
Yes,
who are you, please, and welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Dave. It's Mike Listener.
Hi, Mike.
I've been watching this, and I had no specific question, but I just want to comment on just an excellent presentation. And this really illustrates how intricate and how sophisticated something like this is. I mean, you take people who write about this, and they make it seem easy, but when you really get right down to it, this is a pretty involved process, and kudos to your guests today. They did an awesome job.
Hey, guys, would the Russians or the Chinese or the Indians, are they using something comparable when they plan their missions? Like Phobos Grunt, for example, did it go through a similar kind of trajectory analysis?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I think it deals a lot with Russian culture, too. Russians tend to plan a nominal trajectory, and then if something goes wrong, they scramble. This time it caught up with them. It was a way to recover this vehicle, and I actually wrote a paper about it, which if anyone wants a copy of it, it's public domain as far as I'm concerned. Just don't modify it. So if they want a copy, if you wouldn't mind, David, asking as go-between, I'll get it out to them. But it's very technical. The Russians didn't appear to be aware of there was this countdown clock running that was much shorter than the time they had to launch their vehicle. Once they did launch it, the countdown clock was running, and it was going to run out in a matter of days, not weeks. And they never, at least in the U.S. press, they never seemed to express a proper level of urgency in, because they committed themselves to an orbit plane that they could not deviate from once they launched. They needed to do their trans-Mars injection, leaving the Earth behind in a matter of just a few days, not weeks. I think they do something similar to this, but they really are cash-strapped, apparently.
If you email it to me before I archive this show, I'll make sure it's in PDF format, and I'll put it on the blog.
Yeah, it's in PDF.
Well, if you email it to me... I'll put it on the blog when I get around to archiving this show. Do the Chinese do something similar?
Chinese I'm even less familiar with than the Russians. The Chinese, I would be very surprised if they didn't do something similar. It really helps, if for no other reason than, the trajectory guys, they're all specialists, and they speak the right language, and they can read a bunch of numbers and visualize the trajectory in their heads. But then when they go upstairs to their management and the Politburo or whatever it is in China, they need a clear way to render what they're doing, and movies like this certainly help. So I'd be surprised if they weren't doing something similar.
Michael, do you have anything else that you'd like to comment on or bring forward?
Nothing, just like to say, reiterate, thank you for such a very detailed piece of information. And, again, congratulations to all for the show. It was excellent.
Thanks, Michael, and we look forward to talking to you on our first-ever legal space policy review for a year on Tuesday night. So
very good.
Should be a lot of fun. Thank you, Michael. Listeners, if someone else wants to use our phone, it is 866-687-7223. Do you want to go on with the film, Dan?
That's fine, and let me echo your appreciation to Michael for an astute observation that that's why they call it rocket science. It is not simple. It's pretty straightforward after you study it enough, but it's not simple. And then when you try and bring the technology necessary to bear on the trajectory you've designed, that is not simple either. And I think Elon Musk, for one, could elucidate and expound for hours on what he has learned since he thought it was simple and easy.
You have another caller who wants to get in. Hi, caller. Welcome. Who are you, please?
This is John from Winter Haven.
Hi, John from Winter Haven. Hey. Go for it.
This analysis seems pretty, complex, of course. I'm wondering, what's the likelihood of a mission like this actually going forward when you're competing against so many other ones that are want to go closer to the moon or something else? It seems like this is more of an exercise to develop capabilities than an actual mission, than a mission you really expect to fly. Is that anything close to real?
Well, I like to think that this is the next logical step. Assuming we have a space-worthy, deep space-worthy vehicle like Orion and a heavy-lift booster like SLS. Now, we may use different designs than what I'm assuming for this trajectory, but this is a logical next step because it's, it's not low Earth orbit. You're out there beyond the protection of the Earth's atmosphere and magnetosphere. Almost all the time out there. There's good exploration you can be doing on the moon, but it's not flying out to a near-Earth asteroid. It's not flying out to Mars. Those missions take months, years. And so this allows you to get back within a week, certainly, to the Earth if something goes wrong. So it seems to me that, it's advancing the state-of-the-art of human exploration of space without, going in over your head right away.
Yeah. Actually, I was more in line of there's a lot of people going to be competing for funding for different missions. I just wonder what the likelihood of this particular one going was.
Well, if you're talking about missions that, let's say, land on the moon, those will cost even more because you need to develop, in that case, a lunar landing system of some type, and you need even more propellant, actually, to fly that landing because you go down deep into the moon's gravity well and stop. And then you have to climb back out again. And so a lunar landing is about the only other deep space mission I could come up with that didn't put you out into at least near interplanetary space. Did you have anything else in mind?
Actually, I was thinking more if you were exploring the near the far side of the moon, an eccentric orbit around the moon would get you in within, say, 1,000 kilometers. You could do quite a few orbits and get a better look with less instruments and stuff like that. I've never really had any appreciation for the L points being all that useful. Compared to, getting in closer to the gravity wells that you're working with. Yeah, I mean, if you're in an eccentric orbit, it doesn't take that much to kick it out and come home if it's necessary. And you could be within three and a half days if it was required. Does that make any sense?
It does. But there's, one of these little wrinkles in celestial mechanics that you're getting yourself into here, where if the orbit's elliptical, it's like that elliptical parking orbit I showed you around the Earth, you have a preferred direction of departure for the Earth if you're in elliptical orbits around the moon. Let's say you're 100 kilometers above an interesting site, and then on the high end of the orbit, you may be tens of thousands of kilometers above the moon. Well, now you have this bias in your return trajectory where you can't leave for the Earth with your propellant capability, unless you've got, warp drive, you can't leave for the Earth at an arbitrary time. And so you sort of dug yourself into a hole that you can't get out of for maybe a week or 2 weeks in the worst case. And you have to really watch that. Also, maybe really close to the moon at 100 kilometers up, and you can do some interesting remote sensing. But if you're trying to communicate with a robot that's down there, getting samples really up close and personal, then that robot's going to come and go every orbit. And unless the high point of the orbit is over that robot, you don't have much communication capability.
Okay. I was just curious about the likelihood of this actually going compared to, not really anything in particular, but it just seems like there's a constant fight for funding for this mission versus that rocket versus somebody else. Just kind of a constant argument over who gets to do which. I just wondered how likely this particular one was.
Anyway,
can I interject something?
Plenty on it right now for the next big thing, but we obviously have to wait for NASA to make some kind of official announcement, and I really can't tell you what that announcement is with complete certainty. I just think this has a lot of virtues, from multiple points of view, not only just pure exploration like the elliptical orbit concept, but also being well away from the moon almost all the time so that you're really in interplanetary space and can assess the system's abilities to do things like shield you from cosmic radiation communication from the moon doesn't vary that much, but I really think there's some compelling reasons to be at Earth-Moon L2 before we go anywhere else in this lunar space. It's easy to get home from, and you can do some good exploration as well as assessment of your human habitat system.
Okay. I'm just curious if I get off here and leave room for somebody else.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead, John.
It just seems to me that doing these kinds of exercises and analyses is really important for several reasons, one of which is it at least gives you some facts from which you can argue as opposed to just jumping up and down and waving your arms about. So I think that whether or not this results in a mission is not as important as it analyzes a set of scenarios that can be argued one way or another and strengths and weaknesses compared to other scenarios. And until you run the numbers on all of these things and actually look at what's involved, you're just wasting a lot of energy, as I said, jumping up and down.
Yeah, that's a good point, John. You know, this concept may ultimately not play out. Maybe Earth Moon L1 is a better place to fly to first. But you probably won't set a new human altitude record, and there's a lot of gee whiz factor about that. Going out beyond the moon, beyond the moon's far side, probably will set a new human altitude record. We never got much further than about 100 kilometers above the moon's far side. And if you happen to fly out there, you know, on when the moon's at apogee, then you set a new human altitude record. And that actually occurred on Apollo 13 when they just did a lunar flyby. They happened to hit the moon near its apogee. And so they set an altitude record that stood ever since. And almost certainly an Earth-Moon L2 mission will break that record.
I have an email.
Another point.
Go ahead, John.
Another point that comes from your discussion a little earlier about the Russians, it seems to me that by lacking the depth of analysis, perhaps because of funding limitations or cultural reasons of other types, they might short-circuit some of these things, but the first thing that would happen whenever you're too skinny with a budget is these kinds of analyses and the associated contingency planning would tend to disappear first, and to me that means that the odds of recovering from some type of mission anomaly are reduced.
Yeah, the shuttle program in its later years played that game, I thought, very adeptly. I mean, there was no arguing that the budget was going to be reduced, perhaps even more so when we knew it was going to be retired. But the things that were cut didn't amount to assuming a lot of additional risk if the major things went wrong. Now, granted, you didn't look multiple failures deep on the implications and solutions to those scenarios, but still it was a difficult path to tread, and they tread it pretty well, I thought.
I have an email from a listener in Tucson, Arizona, Chris. And he says, I go to space conferences all the time, and I constantly am hearing the absolute essential need for depots and reusability. And I'm hearing more and more about a lunar space elevator as being doable and needed for anything that we're going to do, especially for the surface of the moon. Does any of what you're talking about require a depot or reusability in the rockets? And I suppose since you're at a Lagrange point and over the far side, the lunar space elevator is not relevant for this discussion, correct?
That's interesting. Let me first talk briefly about depots. As I've said on the show before, I tend to be on both sides of the depot debate. To me, it really, really matters where is the depot. You need it to be near your end destination. So whatever mission you have in mind, and they are manifold, what is your end destination is the first question I have. And then when you can expound on that and express what that is, then my advice is the depot needs to be as near to that end destination as possible. So concepts that talk about in-situ resource utilization in particular, I mean, that's where you're not just bringing something from the Earth and caching it near your end destination, but you're actually creating a resource at your or near your destination. That's where the economics of the viability of a transportation or infrastructure really starts to kick over at that point. I mean, now you're operating like an airline. I mean, you don't bring fuel from New York and put it in Paris to fly back with on an airline. We make the fuel in Paris, you know, or get it from some convenient place and have it waiting there at Paris instead of flying it over. And That just seems like the way we need to be looking at space. We certainly don't ask people to fly from New York to Boston and fuel up there before they even head across the Atlantic, unless something's really wrong. And that's, you know, sort of my take on depots. Space elevators are an amazing concept. They tend to be more demanding of material science than anything else. Can we get a material science breakthrough? So it's you know, I don't want to call it warp drive. It's not quite that much of a breakthrough, I think. But it's sort of on a par with warp drive in a sense. You need a breakthrough in material science. But at least it's material science. It's not fundamental physics. So let's assume that we have material with the tensile and compressive strengths necessary to do it. Then, there's obviously space elevator for Earth would be near geo altitude, and it would have this counterweight that extended outward to maintain tension in the elevator below geo to the Earth's surface. There's a possible space elevator on the Moon, and it can go either way. You can have multiple elevators in totally different directions, because where you want the equilibrium point in that case is along the Earth-Moon line, and you go toward the Earth and put the equilibrium point at Earth-Moon L1, as most people have, and then your counterweight goes off in the direction of the Earth. Or you could do it at Earth-Moon L2. You could then have the equilibrium point there, and you know your anchor point would be on the Moon's far side at near 180 degrees longitude, 0 degrees latitude, and then the counterweight would go out beyond the Moon. So either equilibrium point serves equally well. Of course, at Earth-Moon L2, along the Earth-Moon line, you will not have communication with the Earth directly, so you need some kind of supporting infrastructure that would act as a relay to the Earth, if that was important to maintain communication.
Okay.
But otherwise, I see the two sort of equally. In fact, Earth-Moon L2 has the advantage that if you need solar power, you don't get eclipses of the eclipses of the sun that you experience from Earth-Moon L2, they occur due to the Moon and the Earth simultaneously, but the Moon is usually bigger than the Earth from Earth-Moon L2. So the two events tend to collapse into just lunar eclipses of the sun, whereas on the near side of the Moon at Earth-Moon L1, you get an eclipse of the sun by the Earth, let's say, and then an eclipse of the sun by the Moon 30 days later, and then 6 months later on the average, you see the same thing. So you get like double the eclipses from Earth-Moon L1. So there's a lot of consideration to be thought out in choosing between those two points.
Do you want to go and finish your video now?
Sure enough.
Let's do it.
We're at 5 minutes 47.
Okay.
We're at 5 minutes 47 seconds into the video, and I'm going to start in 3 seconds. 2, 1, mark. And we're now falling toward the Earth from Earth-Moon L2. We've already crossed the Moon's orbit. We're moving at 12,000 times real time. As you can see, the Earth spinning below us. You can count the days as you see the Australia go by. So we start out pretty slow, but then you can see us. First, the stars start moving downward as we go further and further under the Moon's, of the Earth's southern hemisphere, and you can see Antarctica, and then we start slowing down because the speed is really increasing ferociously, and we'll end the video as we get near entry interface, and you can see from the longitudes we're looking at on the other side of the Earth is where we're headed, and that's where we wind up doing entry interface just south of California, flying northward to splashdown. So this is the end of the video.
Pretty amazing. John, comments,
yeah,
questions?
Yeah, it'll be some sight to fly anything like this.
Absolutely. John, comments, questions?
it just seems from the video, as it stopped right now, that you're coming in at a pretty steep angle to the atmosphere, and I thought you were looking at about a 6-degree entry angle. So what am I missing?
Just a time skew. We're still 4,800 kilometers above the Earth's surface at this point, and we're at a latitude almost 90 degrees south. That's why. So we have a little bit further to go before we get down to, 42 kilometers up, I think it is. Let me do a conversion here.
Do you want to go back to the regular format?
If you'd like.
Yeah, let's go back for our remaining minutes to our regular format, and hopefully nobody will call in asking to go back to the video again. Listeners, in the meantime, there's still time if you have a question or comment, 1-866-687-7223.
And I'll have the video ready to go if we want to do that.
Okay.
Go back to mirroring mode, but I'll stop the mirroring now. That conversion was 122 kilometers is the entry interface altitude.
Okay.
If we're looking at constrained budgets in our civil space program like we are right now, it seems like we need Congress to approve or say yes to almost whatever we're going to do, even maybe more so than having people within NASA say yes. Seems like they may have an overriding veto. I don't know. It just seems that way. When you were at NASA, did you ever brief Congress, testify before Congress? Did you ever talk about these missions or try to get members of Congress to understand them? What they were about, what's behind them. I know they're not going to understand the nitty gritty of what you're talking about, but getting them to have a different kind of perspective or appreciation, is that valuable, or is all of this, for us space geeks, but that's not really what the policy guys care about?
Well, that's sort of a dangerous game to play when you're employed. You don't want to obviously conflict in your advocacy with your corporate employer's objectives, and that can be very dangerous. And then if you're a civil servant, not a contractor like I was, then you are expressly forbidden from lobbying Congress. So your hands are well tied either way. And one of the reasons I retired when I did at 55 was to be able to get out from under those kind of, they're understandable restrictions that are imposed on employees. And so since then, I've had a few occasional interactions with my local congressman, but nothing very coherent because at least congressional staffers I've dealt with are not very space savvy. And then I've also tried to influence the latest incarnation of the Augustine Commission that served in 2009. And I found that to be a refreshingly open and receptive body of people. They were soliciting actively input, and I did so over a website about what I felt was reasonable lunar architecture using Constellation hardware. That's about as far as I've gone personally. And it's just not easy to get people's attention in positions of authority. You're very right that Congress controls the purse strings, and that's where the bottom line is. Even if you have a president that's actively advocating space, where I've seen some real difficulties for NASA have been where they tell Congress something that ain't quite true. And my latest worry in that regard is that we hear a lot about the space launch system being the most powerful rocket ever built. And that is a really subjective term, in my opinion, particularly when you try and see, well, what mass can the space launch system in its various evolved states, what mass can that put in a standard low Earth orbit? And I just don't hear those kinds of statistics, performance statistics, being documented by NASA. And I'm really worried that we're leading Congress to expect one thing, and we don't have the budget to deliver it.
But do we not have the budget because of Congress or because of some other reason?
Well, I think Congress has been pretty consistent in their advocating a fixed budget for NASA over the decades. You can adjust it for inflation or and you wind up with pretty much a flat curve, and that's at best what we have been promised lately, from any authority in the federal government, anyway, that I've been able to tune into.
As you know, there's lots and lots of opposition to SLS, depending on what segment of the community you happen to come in. Let me just reference New Space, because that's where I see most of the opposition. So can we, and actually John tried to show this in the first series of these webinars with his interactive spreadsheet on payloads and mission planning to LEO. But how essential is a rocket of the capacity of SLS to go beyond LEO, and could Falcon Heavy do it? Elon is also talking about, I forget the name of it, but the super duper quadruple whatever Falcon Heavy, I just forget the name of it, but it's even supposedly bigger than SLS. Could we say, look, we don't really need to put taxpayers' money into something like SLS? My own opinion is they'll probably be scrapped by Congress anyway in 2 or 3 years, because that seems to be their unholy track record, right? But could we do this with Falcon Heavy? I'm making the assumption that Falcon Heavy becomes operational, give or take within the parameters of which it's being promoted to be able to do. I know that it's theoretical right now, but I'm assuming it's a fait accompli. Do we need SLS? Can we do it with a Falcon Heavy? Missions like the one you described today?
Yeah. The difference is measured in the number of launches necessary before you can do translunar injection. Once you go beyond one launch, then the implication is that you're going to need to do multiple rendezvous before you do translunar injection as well. And once you do the first launch of supporting a contemplated translunar injection, you are committed to an orbit plane that says, okay, I can only fly out to the moon at certain times of a lunar month. And depending on other objectives of the mission, science, things like that, you may wind up with things in the dark when you can fly out. You also are incurring a lot of schedule overhead and schedule risk, which are going to make a good mission planner pad the schedule. So what you may think only needs 4 launches may need 5 launches because the planner spread it out, you know, and front-loaded it so much and moved it to the left so much that some of your resources that you're putting up there, presumably cryogenic propellant, are going to boil off to the degree that's necessary to launch one more vehicle than you thought you should have to. Of course, there's a lot of people that are saying, even in low Earth orbit where the thermal environment isn't the best, that we can achieve near zero cryo boil off over periods of months. And all I can say is I'm waiting for the demo, because this was really going to take to prove that case. So we need to have some kind of critical path to this capability that involves all kinds of demonstrations of new technology. Yeah, granted, we suppose we've got somebody willing to build the vehicle for free, but I really question that. You know, Elon's had a lot of help from NASA to get where he is right now with Falcon 9 and Dragon. So I think NASA's going to be paying for a good hunk of this other path call it commercial if you want, but I don't think it's really commercial if NASA's subsidizing it. And by the time you're done with all the propellant transfer technology demos and cryo boil off demos and showing that you can do automated docking and how to do all this reliably enough to support a timeline, I think even SLS in one form or another could be flying if the budget weren't taken away from it. And then you have a much simpler architecture. So, and anyone that advocates these depots, sooner or later, if they're talking honestly, they'll say, well, it would be a lot simpler if we just had heavy lift. We'd certainly have less launches and maybe even just one launch to escape the Earth's vicinity. So I look forward to being witness to this issue as it plays out. Hopefully we get some kind of deep space capability again. That's what I really want to see.
I do have a caller waiting to talk to you, gents. But, John, do you want to chime in on this discussion given your last webinar presentation?
All I can say is that it ratifies some of the things I was trying to get across and much more eloquently than I was doing it. But I think that it's an important argument to be made because propellant depots are not going to solve all of our problems. And mostly what people end up doing is zeroing out the cost of getting all that propellant up into some orbit. And then once it's there, you have to make use of it. And then the laws of probability really do come into play if you're trying to do some kind of mission.
In terms of flying to the moon, I like depots that are out near the moon, maybe even on the moon's surface if that's your end destination. And I really like the ones that make gas out there. That's another open question in terms of its viability. People talk about macroscopic amounts of tons of water on the moon that are available for cryogenic propellant production. It's like it's almost a given thing, and the jury's out on that still. That is not a done deal. It is not a scientific fact. There needs to be a lot more exploration of the moon's resources in order to prove that these macroscopic quantities of water really exist on the moon.
Let's see who our caller is. It'll probably be the last one for today. Hi, caller. Welcome. Who are you, please?
This is John in Atlanta.
Hi there.
By the way, excellent presentation. I want a question on the configuration of the SLS version that you're using for your mission here you're showing. What is its payload to LEO capability, that variant that we're talking about?
Oh, boy, that is a loaded question. And I've done some computation, but I really shudder to give the results because there's so many puts and takes. When somebody says payload to LEO, they rarely are talking about some standard definition of LEO. You need to talk about altitude and inclination and where your launch site is and all those things in order to compare apples and apples. I've gone bonkers trying to compare what SLS in its various evolved configurations can do with respect to the Saturn V. Now, the Saturn V, I know very well what it can do. There's all kinds of data out there as flown trajectories. There's no paper rockets involved that, that flew to this altitude, this inclination, launched from the Cape, and it put 140 metric tons into basically a 185-kilometer orbit that was near due east launch from the Cape. And I'm sorry, but I haven't heard an SLS performance number that reaches 140 metric tons, or 130 metric tons is the highest I've heard lately, and I just don't know what that means, because no one will say, well, we ran that orbit to this really elliptical case that was a given in the study I participated in. They won't say anything like that. So I still don't know what's more powerful, a Saturn V or an SLS, evolved SLS, based on HARP data. So I'm really scratching my head. It's Congress being promised one thing while NASA delivers something short, or what?
Yeah. Well, what about the? I was thinking more. Yeah, this early variant you're having with the Delta 4 upper stage is substituting for the real SLS upper stage. Let's say just the orbit you use for this mission. What would that put into LEO for that parking orbit you used? So that might be way to make specific.
I get where you're headed, John. I'm sorry. That's basically your 70 metric ton capability, and I'm not sure, again, I can't make my numbers agree exactly with 70 metric tons. It's because the orbit is, it's 1,800 kilometers high on the apogee end and negative on the perigee end. It's like, I can't compare that to what somebody else may be thinking when they ask, the question, how much mass in LEO? So I have to, what I've played with is trying to morph that orbit into 185 kilometer circular orbit. And what propellant would that take? And then what's the mass of that propellant added on to what actually gets injected by the vehicles that we assumed for the study? And then I wind up with something that's close. It's like 66 metric tons, but I didn't add any extra structure to house the propellant. And it's like, I didn't maintain proper mass ratio. I assumed zero extra mass to house that extra propellant. And it's propellant that we aren't actually launching, so the whole vehicle becomes fictitious at that point. And I'm just waving my hand saying, well, it's something near 70 metric tons is about the best I can say. And that's, the initial capability that NASA promised Congress for SLS, core stage and the ICPS upper stage.
Okay. Well, I get the idea. Okay, so that is the number that they originally counted. It's somewhere in that ballpark, but maybe not exactly, given the details of how you actually fly it and so forth. All right, well, thanks a lot. I appreciate your presentation. I thought it was very informative.
Thank you, John. Appreciate your calling in. Gentlemen, we're a little past the 2 hours, so let's see if you have anything that we've left out we should have talked about that you wanted to talk about. Dan, have we omitted anything? Anything you need to make sure we cover?
No, I think that's pretty thorough, and if there's any kind of follow-on, I'll be glad to try and answer it.
John, anything from your perspective we've forgotten, omitted, we should have covered, or you want to cover?
Well, we've covered the L2 mission needs from the standpoint of orbital dynamics. I think it would be fun to take that out to a mission to Mars sometime, too, at a future date.
Yeah,
in this kind of detail, it would certainly help.
Or what, Dan? What were you saying?
Or a near-Earth object, for that matter. Of course,
or a NEO.
Yep.
That's right. I think that would be very instructive for your listeners, David.
Well, if you want to do another one, of course, you don't have any visuals for going out to Mars other than that YouTube one with Jim, correct, Dan?
That's all I have, but it depends on what do you want to see when we go out there, because Celestia can render anything you can fly. So,
what is there to see?
There's loads of missions to NEO.
What is there to see on the way out to Mars, or do you plan the shortest possible transit time due to the human factors issues that are existing with the kind of rockets that we have today?
Yeah, there's not much to see on the way out to Mars. If you were really lucky on the timing, you might see a transit of the sun by Earth, but that's about the only thing to see out there on the way out. And, the mission's going to last 6 to 8 months using reasonably conventional propellants. So generally what I tend to show is departure from Earth and arrival at Mars and high step-ahead rates between the two.
Any closing comments, Dan? Pearls of wisdom, what you would like to leave with our listeners for today?
Well, just that we ought to be looking to hear something soon, hopefully, from an official source at NASA that says Earth Moon L2 is effectively the first stepping stone on the flexible path. To me, that's the most coherent, long-term strategy, vision, if you will, that I've heard advocated post-Constellation. And I'm hoping very much to see that become official space policy and goal here very soon.
Who replaced you as a FIDO at NASA? Do you have a replacement there?
Well, right now, FIDOs are an extinct species because there's no shuttle to fly. And they're the trajectory folks for shuttle. There is a trajectory operations officer called Topo that does analogous trajectory support on the space station flight control team, and they continue to function and do a bang-up job keeping the station safe from debris impacts and planning visiting vehicle visits, as well as coordinating jettisons from the space station and all the international partners involved.
So if I said, what does Dan Adamo and an Apatosaurus have in common, and the answer is extinction, I would be correct.
That's right. That's right. Although FIDOs have been extinct before and then been reincarnated by a new program, so we can always hope.
John, do you have any closing comments, pearls of wisdom from you, please?
Well, I think this presentation has been excellent, and it just underscores the complexity of all the planning that's involved here. And I think far too many people who are space advocates tend to oversimplify to the point where they can't really argue effectively about their points of view or their wish list.
Okay. Dan, we'll be in touch about teaching at UND and the fifth grade class I now know in Missouri that really loves space. They have two bang-up teachers that just really bring space to life for their class, and it's so refreshing. And the kids, you know, I hope they hold their excitement as they get older, but, boy, they can't wait to ask a question and be involved. I mean, it's better than Christmas talking to that class. So, gentlemen, that will wind us up for today. Listeners, I will archive this with the audio on the Space Show site when the video is edited and processed by our engineer, Tom Grigger. It will all go up at the same time, and hopefully that will be within a few days. And, of course, I will keep you posted on that. I want to thank all of you for joining us. And certainly want to thank Dan and John for joining us as well. Back tomorrow with our regular space show schedule on Monday, Madhu Thangalevu from UND from USC is back with his student Jake Dodd, who for that architecturally creative design class designed an on-orbit space nuclear making fuel station. I think I got that right. Talk about pretty creative, far out architectural wild designs. They're fun to talk about. Thank you all for joining us, and goodbye from all of our guests and the Space Show.